Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, December 1st. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Opening Statements Begin Wilson Trial. Jurors view body cam footage, hear witness account of officer's death. By Iris Foster, Reporter Telegram. The first day of the pandemic-delayed trial of David Wilson for the fatal shooting of Midland Police Officer Nathan H. Heidelberg included opening statements and officer body cam footage of events of March 5, 2019. The trial was delayed weeks because of a COVID outbreak. Those impacted included Judge George Jody Gillis, who was still recovering from illness. Retired Judge Tryon Lewis was named to preside over the case, which is taking place in a 10th floor auxiliary courtroom at the Midland County Courthouse. Opening statements were given by Prosecutor Andrew Van Der Hoven and Daniel Hurley of Lubbock for the defense. Van Der Hoven began by asking jurors to consider if Wilson was acting reasonably when he fired his 9mm gun at Heidelberg. He acknowledged the defendant's good standing in the community, but called into question the series of decisions he made during approximately 4 minutes in the early morning hours of March 5th that led to the officer's death. The prosecutor then discussed elements of the case that included a faulty electronic signal to the alarm company. He also recapped the events involving a police training situation that turned deadly. Hurley stated that Tuesday marked the 1,000th birthday since the tragic shooting and recognized that it had a profound effect on two well-respected Permian Basin families who even attended the same church. He mentioned that 3 days before the original November trial date, prosecutors re-indicted the defendant on a charge of first-degree murder, which carries a much stiffer punishment. To that charge, the defendant pleaded not guilty, he said. He also stated that the Wilson family did not arm the sophisticated security system installed by the previous homeowner, who also fully soundproofed the house. He briefly described the Castle Doctrine as it pertains to Texans and when the use of deadly force by a homeowner is justified. Midland County District Attorney Laura Nodolf called former Midland Police Officer Victoria Alley as the state's first witness. A provincial police officer, at the time of the shooting, Alley said that she had only begun field training with Heidelberg on March 1, 2019. As she described the events from March 5th, she admitted she was inexperienced at responding to home burglaries where someone was present. During about 4 hours of testimony and cross-examination, she gave a minute-by-minute account of her unit's response, without lights or sirens, to a call from the dispatcher who had received a call from the alarm company about a pool overdoor alarm. Ali's body camera was the only one recording their arrival to the completely dark property in the 3300 block of Eagle Cove. So the jury and 20 family members heard and saw the response of the two officers, the fatal shot, and the aftermath. She was questioned repeatedly about the unlatched front door, the people she saw inside when Heidelberg announced the police department's presence, and her position at the time the shot was fired. Testimony from two Texas Rangers occupied the last hour and a half of that day. Ranger Chad Matlock compiled the video from David Wilson's infrared interior security system and tried to sync it with the body camera video, so a three-way split screen showed the porch, the view from the living room, and the view from the outside looking in. As the day ended, Ranger Cody Allen was describing his entry into the case, securing the crime scene. His debriefing and photos of Alley, Officer Bailey Mims, and Officer Alexander Duell, and his extended observation of a distressed Wilson in handcuffs in the living room. This article is entitled, U.S. Seeks Dump Sites for Used Nuke Fuel. Andrews' Option, Despite Opposition Over Earlier Process, by Ari Natter, Bloomberg. The Biden administration is looking for communities willing to serve as temporary homes for tens of thousands of metric tons of nuclear waste currently stranded at power plants around the country. The Energy Department filed a public notice Tuesday that it is restarting the process for finding a voluntary host for spent nuclear fuel until a permanent location is identified. Hearing from and then working with communities interested in hosting one of these facilities is the best way to finally solve the nation's spent nuclear fuel management issues, Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm said in a statement. The agency, in its notice, requested input on how to proceed with a consent-based process for a federal nuclear storage facility, including what benefits could entice local and state governments and how to address potential impediments. Federal funding is also possible, the notice said. Approximately 89,000 metric tons of nuclear waste is being stored at dozens of nuclear power plants and other sites around the country. Congress in 1987 designated a ridge in the Nevada desert about 90 miles north of Las Vegas called Yucca Mountain to be the nation's repository. But decades of political opposition led by Nevada Democrat and former Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid kept the project from moving forward. In 2010, President Barack Obama scrapped the plan, and the Biden administration opposes its use as well. Instead, Granholm earlier this year said the administration plans to work with Congress and states to find temporary storage until a permanent repository is found. The department began work on developing a consent-based approach in 2015, but that work was halted during the Trump administration, the agency said. The former president had supported the Yucca Mountain project, but reversed himself last year while campaigning for Senator Dean Heller, a Nevada Republican who went on to lose his re-election bid. And his administration said it was willing to consider interim storage sites as well. One such interim storage site could be in Andrews. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission in September approved a license for a proposal by Orano CIS LLC and its joint venture partner J.F. Lehman & Company's Waste Control Specialists LLC to establish a repository in the heart of Texas's Permian Basin oil fields for as many as 40,000 metric tons of radioactive waste. The joint venture envisioned having nuclear waste shipped by rail from around the country and sealed in concrete casks where it would be stored above ground at a site about 30 miles, 48.28 kilometers, from Andrews. But the plan has drawn opposition from Texas authorities and local officials who once embraced it as an economic benefit, but have since had a change of heart. A similar nuclear waste storage project proposed in New Mexico by Haltech International Group is awaiting approval by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. The agency said it expects to make a decision on that proposal in January 2022. We are very optimistic and hopeful, Catherine Huff, the Energy Department's Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for Nuclear Energy, told reporters on a phone call Tuesday. She added it would be years before such a facility would be selected and licensed, and a law requiring a permanent nuclear storage site first would need to be addressed. Spent nuclear fuels consist of isotopes such as plutonium that remain radioactive for tens of thousands of years. Critics of the concept of interim storage sites question whether they will be truly temporary once the nuclear waste travels there by train or truck. DOE makes a mistake in trying to find an interim nuclear waste site before a permanent site has been identified and vetted, said Jeff Fettes, director of the Natural Resources Defense Council's nuclear program. Communities, especially vulnerable environmental justice communities, will rightfully fear having the entirety of the nation's toxic nuclear waste burden in their backyards forever. This article is entitled, Pioneer Donates $2 Million in Land to Local Habitat for Community. Director, 35 acres would be biggest subdivision we've ever built. By Mella McEwen. Records were broken Tuesday when Pioneer Natural Resources presented the deed to 35.52 acres in the eastern part of the city to Midland Habitat for Humanity. The donation, valued at nearly $2 million, is the largest land donation ever received by the nonprofit. It will be a lot of houses, said Joey Hopkins, executive director of Midland Habitat for Humanity. It will be the biggest subdivision we've ever built and the biggest new subdivision built in this part of town. Looking over the parcel of land, Emily Staten Smith, Associate General Counsel at Pioneer and Vice President of Habitat for Humanity's Board of Directors, said donating the land was a no-brainer that quickly received approval from upper management. She expressed pride in her team that helped bring the donation to fruition. Pioneer has established a long-time relationship with Midland Habitat for Humanity, dating back to 2012. In recent years, Pioneer and its employees have built 6 houses, having given $437,000 to the agency, according to a press release. As a member of the Habitat Board, Staten Smith said she has served on the Family Selection Committee and frequently heard from applicants that they just need a break. Applicants are trying to go back to school or save money for a home amid what she called crushing rents and just need that one break, she said. Building equity in a home and having a home is a key to the American dream, Staten Smith said. Habitat offers people the ability to realize that dream and enjoy the security and stability home ownership can provide, she said. Agatha Lopez described how Habitat changed her life as the organization provided her and her children with a home. I'm thankful I built my own home with my own 2 hands, and I'm thankful for the help of so many Habitat volunteers, she said. After moving into the home, she said her children became better students and she became a better parent because the stress of finding a place to live was gone. Lopez finished her education and has been a teacher for the last 7 years, teaching at Yarborough Elementary. With her children, now young adults, and her education finished, she said she would absolutely love to volunteer with Habitat. In the 30 years since the Midland chapter was formed, Habitat has built 175 homes for more than 700 people in both Midland and Odessa, said Hopkins. And the need continues, he said. Our housing needs have not changed. COVID did not change our housing needs. There's more need than ever, he said. He explained that for-profit builders are challenged to build affordable housing and still make a profit. But Habitat can build and sell them at cheaper prices, he said. The nonprofit is in the process of developing a site plan, including utilities, for the tract, and Hopkins predicted it will be a couple of years before construction begins at the site. Development is a long-term project, he explained. We are starting on the process. Habitat is currently wrapping up its Cloverdale subdivision, and then will be working on its Benton Street subdivision before starting on this new site, he said. This is the local and nation page. This article is entitled, Foundation Announces $2 Million in Grant Funds for Nonprofits. From staff reports. Permian Basin Area Foundation has awarded $1.917 million to nonprofit organizations serving West Texans during its fall grant cycle. The foundation resumed its regular competitive spring and fall grant cycles this year after delaying last year's spring cycle and focused on emergency funding due to the immediate needs presented by the pandemic, according to a news release. Out of an abundance of caution, there was no press conference to announce the grants. I continue to be so proud of our nonprofit organizations who continue to step up and serve our community. Their leadership and impact is immeasurable, stated Grants Administrator Megan Harris. Grants were made to the following organizations: American Heart Association, Aphasia Center of West Texas, Permian Dream Center for Orphans, Basin PBS, Big Brothers Big Sisters of the Permian Basin, Big Spring Symphony Association, Blackwell School Alliance, Buffalo Trail Council, Boy Scouts of America, Bush Tennis Center, CASA of West Texas, Christmas in Action Midland, Inc., Family Crisis Center of the Big Bend, Family Promise of Midland, Fellowship of Christian Athletes, Friends of the Jeff Davis Library, Holy Cross Anglican Church, Hospice of Midland, Junior League of Midland, Delida Smith Safe House, Marfa Education Foundation, Martin County Historical Museum, Midland Community Concert Association, Midland Downtown Farmers Market, Midland Festival Ballet, Midland Storytelling Festival, Midland Odessa Symphony and Chorale, Odessa Arts, Odessa Christmas in Action, Odessa Family YMCA, Opportunity Tribe, Permian Basin Be the Change, Permian Basin Gifts of Hope, Permian Basin Opera, Permian Basin Regional Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse, Sibley Nature Center, Special Olympics Texas, Teen Challenge Adult Centers of Texas, Inc., The Attic Foster Network, the George W. Bush Childhood Home, Inc., the Springboard Center, United Way of Odessa. Semi-annually, the foundation announces competitive grant awards following review of applications submitted in the spring and fall. Spring grant cycle pre-applications are due on April 1, 2022. Visit www.pbaf.org to apply. This article is entitled MSCO to Host Holiday Event Helping Children. Midland County Sheriff's Office has partnered with local nonprofit organizations to have Christmas at the Horseshoe. The free event is scheduled to begin at 5 p.m. A production takes place at 7 p.m. It will feature a Santa Claus, live nativity scene, and arts and crafts. Inner Court and JK Dance Studio will provide their live Christmas music production. MCSO's hope is that as the children exit the doors to go home, they will each leave with a gift, according to a news release from Midland County. Please help by directing our community to drop an unwrapped toy at any listed addresses. Anyone who wishes to donate unwrapped toys for the occasion can drop them off at designated locations. The toy barrels can be found at Midland County Sheriff's Office, 400 South Main Street, Midland County Annex Tax Office, 2110 North A Street, Dollar General, 3305 West Front Street, Dollar General, 1904 Rankin Highway, Dollar General, 10404 FM Road 307, Mulberry Cafe, 2101 West Wadley, Suite 8. City, Water Department Office to relocate. The City of Midland Water Department Customer Service is relocating to 1030 Andrews Highway, Suite 220, near Whitney Drive. This is on the second floor of the CenterPoint Building, which is located next to Wells Fargo Bank. The Water Department will have a soft opening on Wednesday when residents can begin using the new location. After December 6th, The new location will be fully open, and residents will not be able to set up new accounts and make changes to existing accounts at City Hall. The drive-through at City Hall will remain open to pay water bills. In addition to the new location and City Hall drive-through, citizens will still be able to pay their water bill through the online portal and Mr. Payroll at participating KentQuick locations. This article was compiled from staff reports. This is the Business and Oil page. This article is entitled, Shale's New Production Discipline Paying Off, by Kevin Crowley, Bloomberg. Shale drillers' newfound commitment to production discipline appears to be paying off as crude plunges toward a bear market. While West Texas Intermediate crude is poised for the biggest monthly loss since the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic, its collapse isn't dragging down equities the way it used to. The S&P Oil and Gas Exploration and Production ETF is notably outperforming the U.S. benchmark, and three of the top 10 stocks in the S&P 500 index this year are oil companies: Devon Energy Corporation, Marathon Oil Corporation, and Diamondback Energy, Inc. It looks like the market is starting to reward better behavior by producers, said Josh Young, Chief Investment Officer at Bison Interests, a Houston-based money manager. They're not getting punished as much on the way down. Publicly listed oil producers have drastically changed their business model since COVID-19, slowing production growth and harvesting more cash flow to repay debt and hand back to shareholders through dividends and buybacks. While it's early days, the new model appears to be working, with stocks apparently more resilient to the possibility of another pandemic-induced downturn. In the past, a collapse in crude prices would trigger plunging cash flows and mounting debts for shale companies, leading to rapid production cuts, frenetic hedging, calls to bankers begging for forgiveness, and in the worst cases, bankruptcy. But after a decade of lagging stock performance and multiple price wars with OPEC Plus, the sector appears to have put the brakes on unrestrained production growth. Now, many oil exploration and production companies are only reinvesting around half their cash flows in new drilling, compared to 100% or more before the pandemic. That means more cash for shareholders. The lack of long-term supply growth also means that longer-dated crude contracts haven't fallen as much as the spot price, which benefits equity valuations. This article is entitled, U.S. Meets with Saudi Officials to Ease Tensions, by Javier Blas, Bloomberg. The U.S. is trying to refocus its energy relationship with top Middle East OPEC countries, notably Saudi Arabia, after a period of tension between Washington and Riyadh over high oil prices. Amos Hochstein, the top American energy diplomat, held meetings this week with officials in the Middle East, including Saudi Energy Minister Prince Abdulaziz bin Salman on Tuesday. We discussed areas where the U.S. and Saudi Arabia can partner to invest in the energy transmission and collaborate to build a 21st century clean energy architecture, Hochstein said. The meeting comes after a difficult period in relations between the two countries that saw U.S. President Joe Biden releasing millions of barrels from his country's strategic petroleum reserve to push oil prices down. Washington opened the taps after the OPEC Plus alliance led by Saudi Arabia and Russia refused to increase its oil production quickly. This article is entitled, Crude Futures Fall 21% in November, by Julia Fonseres, Bloomberg. Oil in New York slid more than 5% after Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell said the strong U.S. economy may warrant ending the central bank's asset purchases sooner than planned next year. Powell's comments during a Senate Banking Committee hearing in Washington moved financial markets Tuesday, as investors bet that a looming end to the taper could lead to an increase in interest rates. While tighter monetary policy can be a sign of economic strength, it's typically bearish for commodities. West Texas Intermediate crude futures briefly dropped below $65 a barrel for the first time since August during the session, while the global benchmark Brent also tumbled. West Texas Intermediate crude for January fell $3.77 to settle at $66.18 a barrel in New York. U.S. crude futures slumped about 21% in November, the most since March 2020. That ties back to crude oil, because if you start to pump the brakes on economic growth, you start to see impact on demand, said Rebecca Babin, senior energy trader at CIBC Private Wealth Management. The oil market is also continuing to weigh the impact of the Omicron variant of the COVID-19 virus on demand, and what OPEC Plus may decide to do in response when the producer group meets later this week. New travel restrictions threaten the rebound in global crude consumption that has underpinned this year's price rally. The arrival of the Omicron variant and the ensuing oil price sell-off has increased the odds that the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and its allies will opt to pause the planned monthly production increases when they meet, according to RBC Capital Markets. This is the local nation from the front page. This article is entitled, Railroad Commission Adopts New Rules in Response to Storm, by Mella McEwen, Midland Reporter-Telegram. With winter approaching, state regulators continue to take steps to address extreme weather emergencies like those seen during Winter Storm Uri in February. The Railroad Commission Tuesday adopted rules for critical designation of natural gas infrastructure to help during energy emergencies. The new rules implement provisions in House Bill 3648 and Senate Bill 3 passed this spring, and define natural gas facilities that would be designated as critical gas suppliers and critical customers. Under the new rules, critical gas suppliers include, but aren't limited to, natural gas wells, oil leases that produce gas, natural gas pipeline facilities, underground natural gas storage facilities, and saltwater disposal facilities. Critical customers would include facilities that require electricity to operate and must submit critical customer information to their electric utilities, to the utilities to have updated and correct information for purposes of supplying power to the facilities. Permian Basin Petroleum Association members appreciate Railroad Commission Chairman Wayne Christian, as well as Commissioners Christy Craddock and Jim Wright, and their staff and all agency personnel who have worked so hard on crafting a rule that heeds the public call to ensure that vital natural gas produced in Texas is delivered to homes and for electric generation. Ben Shepard, president of the Permian Basin Petroleum Association, told the Reporter-Telegram by email. He added, natural gas is the most reliable and abundant energy source in the state, and its use has been revolutionary in advancing a cleaner and more reliable electric grid. The work done at the RRC to stand up a critical infrastructure division, complete more than 1,000 inspections, and now address the regulatory shortcomings that allowed power to be disconnected at natural gas production sites during the storm, are all fundamental to enhancing a dependable grid that Texans deserve. The new rules drew criticism from some groups, like Environment Texas. Executive Director Luke Metzger said in a statement, federal investigators were quite clear that failures to winterize the gas supply chain were a major factor in the February blackouts. We're glad the staff and commission listened to reason and reduced the number of companies allowed to opt out of doing their part to protect our grid. He expressed concern the rule would give too many gas companies a free pass to avoid requirements, saying a $150 fee to shirk responsibility is outrageous, especially if it's in state law. That's pocket change to the oil tycoons. The gas industry wants to have its cake and eat it too. They want all their wells to be critical enough to not get their power shut off during an emergency, but not so critical as to require them to winterize. You can't have it both ways. Christian expressed that applications for exception require objective evidence that will be renewed, and that commission staff can deny any application. It has been wrongly reported that for $150 any company can be exempted from preparing for winter, he said in a statement. The $150 is a fee set in statute 2 decades ago for all applications for exceptions. It is just an application fee, not a get-out-of-jail-free card. No company will automatically receive an exemption, and applications can and will be denied. Ed Longenecker, president of the Texas Independent Producers and Royalty Owners Association, noted in a statement that facilities designated by the Texas Electricity Supply Chain Security and Mapping Committee, due next year, will not be eligible to apply for an exception to critical designation. Like Christian, he noted that an exception is not an automatically granted upon filing the application form and paying the fee. There are several more steps that will be implemented to help fortify the state's energy supply. In addition to the work by the Commission and the Public Utility Commission to map the state's energy supply chain and natural gas infrastructure along that chain, Commission inspectors have been visiting gas facilities and leases to observe winter preparation measures. This is the obituary column. Wednesday, December 1st. Deborah Ann Bohannon. Deborah Ann Bohannon was born in Houston on October 2, 1951, to Robert and Ina Stout. Deborah Ann Bohannon is survived by her two beloved sons, Eric Dean Bohannon, spouse Tiffany of Midland, and Trey Ross Bohannon, spouse Allison of the Woodlands, 4 amazing grandchildren and 1 great-granddaughter. Deborah is also survived by twin sister Jan Nichols, spouse Max of Big Spring, and a brother Jerry Stout, spouse Patty of Odessa, as well as many nieces, nephews, and cousins. Deborah Ann Bohannon is preceded in death by her soulmate Leroy Dean Bohannon, 2 beautiful twin sons, Keith and Kyle, as well as her parents Robert and Ina Stout. Memorial service will be held at 10 a.m. Friday, December 3rd at Nally Picklin Welch Funeral Home Chapel. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Fabian Sanchez Ramos. Fabian Sanchez Ramos, 58, of Midland, passed away peacefully on Wednesday, November 24th, surrounded by his loving family. Fabian was born in Stanton to Leonardo and Rosa Ramos on July 22, 1963. The viewing will be held on Thursday, December 2nd, beginning at 10 a.m., and rosary will follow at 7 p.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home and Chapel. Funeral services will be held Friday, December 3rd at 2 p.m. at Our Lady of Guadalupe Catholic Church. Burial will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. He is survived by his mother, Rosa Ramos, and his son, Michael Rodriguez, and wife, Amy, daughter, Christina Garza, and son, Fabian Ramos, and wife, Ana Ramos, 12 grandchildren and 1 great-grandchild, brothers, Rudy, Eddie, and wife, Gloria, Leonardo Ramos III, and wife, Lucy, sisters Zoila Reyes and husband Johnny, Carol Dominguez and husband Chano, Linda Baeza and husband Arturo, Yolando Ramos, Paula Valdez, and husband Andy Valdez of San Antonio. Also many beloved nieces, nephews, cousins, and other family members. Fabian is preceded in death by his father, Leonardo Ramos, whom he missed very greatly and loved very much. Funeral Mass is under the direction of Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home and Chapel. Online condolences may be emailed to pipkin@nts-online.net or visit our website at www.LlewellynGarciaPipkinFH.com. Jonelle D. Price Hamilton. Jonelle D. Price Hamilton, 72, entered into the presence of her Lord Jesus on Thanksgiving Day, Thursday, November 25th. Joan was born on November 12, 1949, in Kermit, to Paul and Jean Price. Joan is preceded in death by her parents, Paul and Jean Price, and one nephew, Brian Price. She is survived by her husband of 47 years, Adrian, son Brandon and wife Becky of Midland, son Zane and wife Shelley of De Quincey, Louisiana, brother Paul, Jean, and his wife Sherry of Garland, brother Robert and wife Kathy of Rowlett, Texas, as well as her grandchildren and nieces and nephews. The family will receive friends at Ella's funeral home on Thursday, December 2nd from 6 to 8 p.m. Funeral service will be at 10 a.m. on Friday, December 3rd at Seven Cities Church, 5110 West Illinois. Officiated by Reverend Curtis Benninghoff, with interment at Rest Haven Cemetery to follow. John R. Slauson. John R. Slauson, 84 years old, went to his heavenly home to be with his beloved wife, Emma Lee, on November 25th. A visitation will be held 5 to 7 p.m. Friday, December 3rd at the Nellie Pickle Welch Funeral Home in Midland. A memorial service will take place 10 a.m. Saturday, December 4th at the Nellie Picklin Welch Chapel, followed by the interment at Rest Haven Memorial Park. He was born in Carrollton, Mississippi, January 21st, 1937. John is survived by his children and their spouses, Barry and Vicki Slauson, Mark and Sandy Hill, Dylan and Douglas Ketterman, and Karen Kirksey and Wesley Holmes. His sister Pauline Mullins and brother Bill and wife Faye Slauson. Cynthia and Scott are deceased. He also had many grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Lois Elizabeth Midkiff Cole. Lois Elizabeth Midkiff Cole was born in Midland, County, Texas, on June 18, 1929, to T.O. Dick Midkiff, Jr. and Hattie Mae Midkiff, and passed away peacefully in her home on November 23, 2021. A memorial service will be held on Monday, December 6 at 3 p.m. at First United Methodist Church in Midland, with a reception to follow. She was preceded in death by her parents and her beloved husband, Jerry, of 66 years. She is survived by her son, Doug Cole, Renee of Elgin, Oklahoma, daughter Elizabeth Cole of Midland, and Sally Cole Owen, Chuck of Midland, three grandchildren, three great-grandsons, one brother, Richard Midkiff, Sheila, one sister, Maydell Jackson, and several nieces and nephews. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Rebecca Ann Hopkins. Rebecca Ann Becky Witch Hopkins, age 78, of Midland, passed away Saturday, November 27th. She was born January 19, 1943, in Fort Stockton, to June Feister Witch Elkins and Billy Jack Witch. Becky is survived by her son, Darrell Hopkins, and wife, Sonia, of Midland, granddaughter, Michelle Ryman, and husband, Mason, grandson, Michael Wayne Hopkins. Additional family surviving Becky are her cousins and aunts. She is preceded in death by her mother, June Elkins, stepfather, Joe Elkins, grandparents, Eddie and Ruth Feister of Fort Stockton. Graveside services will be Tuesday, November 30th at 1 p.m. at East Hill Cemetery on the Sanderson Highway in Fort Stockton. Funeral arrangements are under the direction of Heritage Funeral Home of the Big Bend. Remembrances and condolences may be shared with the family at www.heritagefuneralhomeofthebigbend.com. of thebigbend.com. Death Notices. Evans Kessie. Evans Kessie, 45, of Odessa, passed away on October 29th at Medical Center Hospital. Evans was born on May 27, 1976, to the late Kwesi Kiai Bafor and Cecilia Doncor in Orofo, Kumasi, Ghana. He is survived by his wife, Lily Brenya, four daughters, Selina Kessie, Evelinda Kessie, Blessangel Kessie, and Blessangela Kessie. His mother, Cecilia Doncor. Funeral will be held on Friday, December 3rd, at 9 a.m. till 11 a.m. Funeral immediately following at 11 a.m. Burial will follow at American Heritage Cemetery. Arrangements are entrusted to American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home. Jerome Green. Jerome Green, 89, of Midland, passed away November 24th. Memorial service will be held at 3 p.m. Tuesday, December 7th at St. Luke's United Methodist Church. Survivors include wife Frankie. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Jesse Kemp. Jesse Kemp, age 96, of Midland, passed away November 29th. Burial will be Friday, December 3rd at 10 a.m. at Fairview Cemetery. Jesse is survived by six living children. Funeral arrangements are entrusted to Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. Online condolences can be received at www.asanchezTFH.com. Maria Reimer. Maria Reimer, 49, passed away November 28th. A visitation will be held Wednesday, December 1st at Rhinelander Church in Grady, Texas. Funeral services will be held at Thursday, December 2nd at 1 p.m. at the Rhinelander Church in Grady. Burial will follow at Rhinelander Cemetery in Grady. She is survived by her husband, John Reimer, Father Cornelius Ferrer, sons Johann Reimer, Cornelius Reimer, Jacob Reimer, Franz Reimer, daughters Tina Thiessen, Maria Reimer, four sisters and a brother. Arrangements are under the direction of Stanton Memorial Funeral Home and Chapel. Rick Duane Beardsley. Rick Duane Beardsley, 80, of Midland, died Saturday, November 27th in Midland. Graveside service will be held at 10 a.m. December 4th at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Reverend Dr. Jimmy Braswell is officiating. Arrangements are by Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home of Odessa. Robert G. Bob Lester. Robert G. Bob Lester, 79, of Midland, died Sunday, November 28th. Funeral service will be held at 3 p.m. December 2nd at Fairmont Park Church of Christ. Burial will follow at Rest Haven Cemetery. Mike Crowley and Tim Baugh are officiating. Arrangements are by Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home of Odessa.
This is Connie reading the Odessa American for Wednesday, December 1st, 2021. Sewell Lends a Hand to Andrew's Band by Ruth Campbell. Andrews and at least one of its neighboring cities came together Tuesday for an Andrews High School Band fundraiser. Held at the Mustang Bowl, plates of pork chops, green beans, and potato salad were served in two shifts, 11:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. and 4:30 p.m. to 6:30 p.m. Sewell Auto Group donated all the food and supplies, and all the proceeds went to the AHS band, which was involved in a fiery November 19th crash that left the AHS band director, Darren Johns, and longtime retired teacher Mark Boswell dead. A preliminary investigation report from the Texas Department of Public Safety showed a 2016 Ford F-30 truck driven by Nathan Paul Hartle, 59, of Midland, was traveling westbound in an eastbound lanes of Interstate 20 for unknown reasons. A 2005 Motor Coach Industries bus and a 2018 Freightliner bus were traveling eastbound in the eastbound lanes of Interstate 20. The report issued by the Texas Department of Public Safety says the F-350 struck the 2005 Motor Coach Industries bus in the outside lane. The 2018 Freightliner bus also struck the Ford. The Ford caught fire upon impact. The report said the 2018 Freightliner sustained minor damage. The crash occurred near Big Spring and sent 13 students to area hospitals, including 11 to Scenic Mountain in Big Spring and two others to Lubbock's University Medical Center. Three were killed in the crash. The band was on the way to support the Andrews Mustangs in an area playoff game to the second round of the Class 4A Division 1 against Springtown. The game was postponed until Monday following the crash. Donnie Booth, Chief Executive Officer of Permian Regional Medical Center in Andrews, said a similar luncheon was held to support first responders and health care workers in Andrews County. The auto group was very impressed with how well the event went. "We have always worked well together as a community leadership to make sure that the community and citizens of Andrews are as well protected and taken care of as they could be. So then, of course, when the tragedy occurred with the bus accident with the Andrews Band and Andrews Independent School District, Sewell Auto Group again reached out to me and asked if I would help just kind of pull people together," Booth said. He reached out to the mayor, county judge, and other officials and said Sewell Auto Group wanted to have a fundraiser. They had 3,000 plates to be sold for $10 each. They also wanted to feed the band students as well as the teachers for free, so they're allowed to come and eat for free today as well. And then, of course, we're accepting donations and selling the plates for raising the money, Booth said, and it's a great cause. He added that when an event like the bus accident occurs, it takes place for the students, teachers, and the people that were directly involved to move forward. "We're just trying to support them the best way we can and definitely make sure that they don't have any financial needs or anything of that nature." There's already been a large outpouring from not only community members, but also businesses, local businesses as well, who have donated a lot of money and food and anything that they could try to help. Matter of fact, all the individuals that were hospitalized in the different area hospitals, the school, just through donations, was able to pick up food and lodging for all of their family members in those areas, Booth said. "We're working on trying to raise as much money as we can just to try to ease any of the burdens that we can for the victims," Booth said. "Examples would be medical expenses or band equipment that was damaged in the accident, or if they are off work and having trouble paying bills. Whatever it is that they're going to need help with, we're going to want to make sure that we can support them through this tragedy, Booth said. Mayor Flora Braley said, Andrews consistently comes together. And we've had so much support. We're here today for the Andrews ISD, the Booster Club, and there's all sorts of other officials. The county judges here and a lot of volunteers. And that's just the spirit of cooperation that we have here in Andrews. And I want to just thank all the surrounding communities. They have really expressed a lot of prayers and donations, and we appreciate that so much, Braley said. Braley said her reaction after hearing about the accident was probably similar to everyone else's. We were heartbroken. We were heartbroken that we lost two of our members and even the other driver and the students that suffered some injuries also. We're really thankful to have our students back and getting healthy every day, and we're trying to rally around them and do the right thing, Braley said. Randy Nelson, a volunteer firefighter from Seminole, said five of them turned out Tuesday. There are about 38 members. Nelson said they were lending a hand because it was close to home. He added that he was able to get a smoker to cook the food. Andrews and Seminole are in the same high school football class, so they are rivals in a way. But when it comes down to stuff like this, it's matter over mind over matter, Nelson said. He said he was shocked when he heard about the bus crash, because I know if it'd been something from Seminole, it'd be hard to handle, and we'd hope that everybody would pitch in like they are here. Jamie Erickson said he got a call from the band Booster Saturday morning saying they wanted to have a fundraiser. What word got to the Sewell Auto Group and Seminole and the hospitals, fire departments, and EMS personnel pitched in. It's the coolest thing in the world to me is when a community gets together, Erickson said. He added that there were 3,000 pork chops, 200 gallons of green beans, and 1,000 pounds of potato salad. Rudy Barra was busy cooking the green beans. His daughter Aubrey is a freshman trombone player in the AHS band. Barra said Aubrey was good, but she had a small fracture across the nose of her bridge. There is no displacement or anything, so she turned out all right, Barrow said, but it threw a scare in everyone. Starbright Village opening scheduled for Thursday by OA News at OAOA.com. Odessa's famous Starbright Village will kick off this Thursday with a ceremony. Mayor Javier Hoven will light the village at 6:30 p.m. after performances by local choirs and dance groups and an appearance from Santa Claus in McKinney Park at 625 North Pool Road, adjacent to Interstate 20. The Starbright Village Christmas light will run through January 2nd and will feature a new animated fireworks display. The hours for the display each night will be from 6 to 11 p.m. Admission is free, but donations are welcome to keep the event free and add new displays for next year. Another headline from the front page, OC Student Gets Boost from Scholarship by Ruth Campbell. When you meet David Jenkins, the thing that strikes you right away is his positive attitude. That could be one reason he was awarded one of the 10 Positively OC Presidential Scholarship recipients. Under the program, 10 Positively OC scholarships will receive a 2-year scholarship for tuition and fees. The OC website said these scholars will be the trailblazers for future scholars, establishing benchmarks for campus and community engaging social media to share positive messages and content with college stakeholders. Their tweets, posts, snaps, and video will blaze the trail for spreading positivity from a student's lens while promoting the college, our programs, and our services. Their involvement in hashtag PositivityOC will impact student success and increase the college going and college completing culture in our region. Jenkins said he will graduate in 2023 with two associate degrees, one in biology and one in chemistry. And from there, I will transfer to Texas A&M on our pathway program that we have with them, and I'll complete my bachelor's degree in biomedical sciences. If I maintain a high enough GPA and pass the MCAT, I'll have early admission into and to the Texas A&M Medical School, Jenkins said. He has two daughters. His 13-year-old has decided she wants to be a doctor, too. Jenkins said, like him, she is unsure what part of medicine she wants to pursue. Going after a college education and medical degree, Jenkins said he's raising the bar for his family. Being a first-time college student and aiming for a medical degree has put pressure on him, but Jenkins said he wants to inspire his family and give them something to aim for. Director of Media Relations Sherry Dalton said OC has a partnership with A&M where if students successfully complete the curriculum, they are assured a place in the biomedical sciences program. Tim Clark, communications instructor, said it is a 2+2 articular agreement. Biology instructor Clovis Stacy has been the Odessa College representative for the program for many years, Clark said. Clark said the scholarship came about through OC President Gregory Williams taking to Twitter to spread as much positivity around as possible. As part of that, we started thinking, how can we get our students involved? Clark said. Clark said he was tasked with leading a committee to get students to apply and walk them through the process. They had an application process, and students were asked to answer three questions, and then we looked at things such as GPA. They needed to be full-time students as well, Clark said. Based on the responses, we did a blind selection where we had everybody that applied. The committee went through and evaluated their applications, and each individual committee member scored on a 1-5 basis, and we got our top 20 students. We repeated the process and ended up with our top 10. It was done completely blind, Clark said. Jenkins is a 2007 graduate of Permian High School, joined the United States Army for 2 years, and was stationed in Fort Benning, Georgia. He received a medical discharge after suffering appendicitis and had an allergic reaction to the medication he was given. When he started at OC, Jenkins said he had $300 to his name, which was enough to pay for one class. The class was coupled with another class that he couldn't afford to pay for. So he went to financial aid and found out he could get aid through the OC Foundation. He was still waiting for his FAFSA to be approved. The Positivity OC Scholarship can be $1,500 per long semester, and students can be awarded it 4 times total, Clark said. For every 1,000 followers that Williams gets on Twitter, 10 additional students will receive the scholarship. So our hope is by next fall we'll be giving out at least 20, Clark said. One of the things students are challenged to do is participate in the college's weekly Twitter chats. And then the next step is to continue to challenge their classmates to do the same, Clark said.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.